It's time to eat. And do you know what you're going to make? If not, I have a great solution for you. Home Chef. Just last night, I made Thai-style yellow curry chicken with roasted carrots and cauliflower rice. Sounds fancy, but it was super easy to make, and it was pretty inexpensive, too. Home Chef delivers fresh, pre-portioned ingredients with step-by-step recipe cards right to your door. Not only do you learn how to cook an awesome meal, but you save both time and money by not having to go to the grocery store to get more ingredients than you need. And because Home Chef has agreed to sponsor Court Junkie, you can now all get $30 off your first order by going to homechef.com/courtjunkie. That's homechef.com/courtjunkie. Hi, this is Jillian, and you are listening to the Court Junkie Podcast, Episode 8, Part 2. A special thanks to all of you who are listening, subscribing, donating, and leaving me reviews. You are greatly appreciated. And an extra special thanks to my Court Junkie discussion group on Facebook. We're having some really great discussions about this case, past cases I've covered, and basically all things true crime. And the more the merrier. So if you're on Facebook, I would love it if you joined. Now on to part two. In the last episode, you heard about the 1986 murder of Sherry Ray Rasmussen. Sherry and her husband, John Rutten, had only been married for 4 months before John came home from work on February 24, 1986, to find his wife dead on their living room floor. She had been beaten and shot in the chest 3 times. Detectives on the case had determined that it was a burglary gone wrong, but no arrests were ever made. And in 2009, a cold case unit started reinvestigating the case, and what they found was shocking. Advances in forensic science allowed them to test the DNA from a bite mark on Sherry's left arm. And that DNA matched one of their own, Stephanie Lazarus, a fellow NYPD detective who had been on the force for 25 years. They learned that Stephanie had dated John on and off for years, right up until John married Sherry. They also learned that Stephanie had gotten into a confrontation with Sherry at Sherry's workplace, and that Stephanie had reported her gun stolen just 13 days after the murder. They started interrogating Stephanie about her relationship with John, how she heard about Sherry's murder, and about the confrontation they had. We'll continue this episode with the rest of that interrogation, where the detectives start putting the pressure on and really start grilling her about what they've been told by Sherry's friends. And they reveal that there was not only a confrontation at Sherry's workplace, but also potentially one at her home, too.
Well, like I said, as we were looking at the case, and, you know, we had read the notes as far as from Sherry's friends saying, you guys had problems or words, and they got heated. You know, and the reason we're asking you is they had mentioned that an incident at her work had occurred, and they've also told us that an incident at her house occurred.
You know what?
And this is at her house during the period of time that they're married.
That's just not sounding familiar at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, if someone says that I was at her house and I had an incident with her, was John there? Did John say this happened? Because, and other people were there? I don't recall. I mean, it just doesn't sound familiar.
And this is an incident where you showed up, you weren't supposed to show up, and things got heated.
At his house?
Yeah.
That just doesn't sound familiar. I mean,
nothing.
No. You know, it's not sounding familiar.
So
not at all.
Now you're saying not familiar because it's just, don't you remember?
You know what? I'd have to say I don't remember because I don't remember. That doesn't sound familiar.
I mean, would you remember something like that in your life?
I would think.
Sort of drama involving, you know, the other woman type of thing.
Did you ever fight with her?
You mean like we fought?
Yeah. Did you ever duke it out with her?
No, I don't think so. I mean,
you'd remember that, right? That would be pretty.
Yeah, I would think so.
Pretty specific.
Like I said,
dramatic.
Obviously, it just doesn't sound familiar. What are they saying? So I fought with her, so now, I mean, I'm getting the jump, the leap. Excuse me, I haven't eaten. they're saying, okay, I fought with her, so I must have killed her. I mean, come on. I don't even know who these people are. I can't even say I met any of these people. It's insane. If it happened, I honestly don't remember it. That's all I can tell you. I mean,
would it be something you would remember? I mean, because it's, I don't know if any other intense incidents in your life that have occurred, I mean, you'd recall those, right? I mean,
well,
like a use of force at work or car crash, something you're involved in, you'd be like, yeah, I remember.
You would think I would remember. I mean, I would think if it was something that crazy. I can't say, you say, how many fights have you gotten into in your life? A few at work.
Well, fights at work are kind of different because we've all had uses of force or whatever. But
well, I mean,
didn't
even have even a lot of those.
But you know, if you're actually,
I mean, I've played.
Like if Dan and I got mad at each other and we threw blows in the squad room, I mean, 20 years later, I would remember it. I mean,
I would think
would
remember it. But that's what I'm saying. That's not sounding familiar to me at all.
Let me ask you: throughout your life, would you remember the number of fights you've been involved in? And I don't mean kind of like a bump or something, just a physical fight where you. Everybody's hitting each other, scratching, pulling, you know, whatever.
Maybe. I mean, I can't say I've been in a lot. You know, I played sports.
Yeah.
You know, you get into scuffles there and...
Mm-hmm.
And you recall some of those, right? I mean, just...
Yeah, I can recall some of them.
Games get intense.
Yeah, but like I said, this you saying, but that's just not ringing a bell to me.
But it'd be something...
I would think I would remember.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm...
If you're in this,
I would think so too.
If you're in this other girl's house and words are exchanged, I mean, you figure you recall.
Well, I would think.
And it's relating to, you know, a guy that you were dating, and but she's dating now, you know, and it's just kind of like a whole love triangle type of thing. I mean, you figure you'd remember that, right?
Well, I would think. I mean, I don't want to still tell you.
Yeah. No, because I'm looking at the notes, and these people are kind of. I mean, they're pointing the finger at you.
Well,
and
I mean, that's not ringing a bell to me, so, you know, I don't know, you know, it's, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, that just sounds crazy to me.
Yeah, so you, offhand, you don't recall ever going into her house and having words and physically, you know.
No.
Attacking her attacking you.
No.
Nothing like that?
No, I mean, that's, no.
Nothing?
No. No, not at all.
Okay.
So Stephanie either truly doesn't remember, or she just won't admit it. The detectives move on, and it becomes even more obvious to Stephanie that she's a suspect.
Well, on some of the, on this case, you know, it occurred in 86, right? Detectives processed the scene, things of that nature. They did fingerprints and all that stuff. You know, you know the standard stuff. I mean, you've been doing this longer than I have.
Well, not about that. I got 26 years on.
Yeah.
Going on 26.
19, so. But as they processed everything, they did the best they could at that time, and they looked at a lot of people and different things in this case. And you're right.
I mean, if you guys are claiming that I'm a suspect, then I got a problem with that.
Okay.
Okay? If you're doing this as an interrogation, you're saying, hey, I'm a suspect. Well, now I got a problem with, you know, now you're accusing me of this? Is that what you're saying?
We're trying to figure out what happened, Stephanie.
Well, I'm just saying, I need to get a lawyer if you're accusing me of this.
I mean, you don't have to. You're here of your own free will. I mean,
no,
you
know. Well, I know, but I mean,
you know you're not under arrest. You can walk out whenever
you can leave whenever you like.
Well, I'm trying to give you some background of, you know, how I knew him, and now you're telling me that somebody's saying that we had this big old fight, and I don't even know what you're talking about, and I don't want to get in trouble for something that I didn't even do, or you're saying I did something.
Okay.
Yeah, we understand.
I mean, how would you guys like it if the tables were turned on you?
I understand. No.
No, that's what we're telling you. I mean, you're free to go whenever you want. If this makes you uncomfortable and you want
to... Well, now you're starting to make me uncomfortable.
The thing is, detectives did what they could at that time on the crime scene. Okay, and the burglary thing you're talking about, that is an angle that they looked at. But now we're looking at everything else on the case. Because nobody was ever arrested on the case.
I don't know that or not.
Okay. Now, what we'd like to do is, obviously you know about all the DNA stuff and things of the nature that, you know, gets done on cases nowadays. If we asked you for a DNA swab, would you be willing to give us one?
Maybe.
Because now
I'm thinking I probably need to talk to a lawyer.
Okay.
Because I know how this stuff works, okay? Don't get me wrong. You're right. I have been doing this a long time.
Yeah.
And I wish I had been recording this because now it sounds like, you know, there's, you know, you're selling these people, say I'm fighting with her, and now it sounds like you're trying to, you know, I've been doing this a long time.
Yeah,
we know.
Okay? And now it almost sounds like you're trying to pin something on me.
No,
now I got that sense.
Well, what it gets to on these cases, and you know it as well as I do, our job is to identify and eliminate suspects.
I can't believe this.
So if we ask you to point, to give us a DNA sample, a buccal swab, so we can identify or eliminate you, would you be willing to do that?
Maybe. Because I know this.
Well, that's where we're at, too. I mean, because right now, from looking at the evidence, it's possible we may have some DNA at the location.
That's great.
And we're going to do what we can to try to put this thing together. And your name's in the book. These people are pointing at you for whatever reason.
I don't know why. And that's just crazy. I mean, that's absolutely crazy.
And it would be irresponsible on our part not to look at it.
I know. You guys have to do your job. And I guess I'm going to have to contact somebody. So
that's fair.
I mean, because I know how this stuff works.
Sure.
I mean, I just can't believe it.
We understand that. I mean, if we were in your position, I mean, we would feel the same way.
I just can't even believe it. I mean, I'm shocked. I'm really shocked that somebody would be saying that I did this. I mean, we had a fight, and so I went and killed her. I mean, come on.
Well,
that's...
Okay.
All right.
Well, thanks for giving me the courtesy. I wish I could keep recording.
Thanks for your time.
Take care.
All right.
It sounds like the interrogation is over, and it is. But immediately after Stephanie leaves the room, she's taken into custody and arrested.
Okay. Stephanie, you know you have the right to remain silent. Do you understand?
Yes.
Anything you say may be used against you in court. Do you understand?
Yes.
You have the right to the presence of an attorney before and during any questioning. Do you understand?
Yes.
If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be appointed for you free of charge before any questioning if you want. Do you understand?
Yes.
Do you want to talk to us right now?
No.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
This is crazy. I'm in shock. I'm totally in shock.
Stephanie was then taken to Linwood, the L.A. County Jail Facility for Women, and was held on a $10 million bail for the murder of Sherry Ray Rasmussen. Within days of Stephanie's arrest, Sherry's dad spoke with reporters and told them that prior to her death, Sherry had confided in him that Stephanie had been harassing her. He said she had called him numerous times to talk about it. She told him during one phone call that Stephanie had shown up in her uniform at the hospital where she was working, and that she told Sherry, "If I can't have John, nobody can." In another call, Sherry told her father that they were getting unwanted visits to their home from Stephanie. She told him that one day she came home to find Stephanie, again in her uniform, standing in their living room. She said she didn't know how Stephanie had gotten into their apartment. Stephanie said she needed to talk to John, and then there was a verbal confrontation between the two ladies. And then, about 2 weeks prior to the murder, Sherry called her father and told him that she was concerned about her safety. She said, "I have a serious problem. I can't tell you about it right now. It's something I have to handle on my own." She told him that she was going to meet with the source of her problem when she got back to LA. Sherry's dad offered her a handgun, but she refused it and said she wouldn't be able to use it anyway. Sherry's father told reporters that he had relayed this information to the LAPD after his daughter's murder, but was essentially ignored until Stephanie's arrest. He said that he had even been told by one of the original investigators, "You've been watching too much TV." This testimony was ruled inadmissible in Stephanie's trial because it falls under hearsay evidence. Early news reports also indicated that John and Sherry's marriage certificate was discovered missing from their home, but that didn't make it into trial either. But here's what did. Stephanie's trial began on February 6th, 2012. The trial was held in downtown Los Angeles, and LA County Superior Court Judge Robert Perry was presiding. Reporters, family members, and curious onlookers packed the courtroom. The prosecution's theory, which they clearly laid out in their opening statements, was that Stephanie had murdered Sherry because Sherry had married the man that she loved. They said she was driven to kill by the jealousy and heartbreak she felt. They believed that Stephanie, with her training and experience as a police officer, got into Sherry's home on February 24th, 1986, physically attacked her, and then shot Sherry 3 times in the chest. And because she was a police officer, she knew how to break into a home, how to not leave fingerprints, and knew how to stifle the gunshots so that nobody would hear them. And after killing her, they believe that Stephanie then staged the scene to make it look like a burglary gone wrong. Deputy District Attorney Shannon Presby showed the jury a photo of Sherry in her wedding dress. He said, Sherry Rasmussen was wearing the gown that Stephanie Lazarus believed was hers. He said, a bite, a bullet, a gun barrel, and a broken heart. That is the evidence that will prove that the defendant murdered Sherry Ray Rasmussen. He told the jurors about the bite mark evidence, that the bite on Sherry's arm had contained DNA that had been matched to Stephanie, a process that wasn't available to them back in the 1980s. He went on to say that Sherry had been beaten and that wounds on her wrists and cords found on the floor indicated that she had been tied up. There was a blanket nearby that had bullet holes in it, which Presby told the jurors was used to stifle the gunshots as the gun was being fired. He said that there was a unique pattern of tearing on the blanket that were consistent with the bullets LAPD officers used at the time, which, of course, Stephanie was. The gun used in the killing had never been found, but Presby said that the gunshot markings showed that a .38 caliber gun had been used, and that just 13 days after Sherry's murder, Stephanie had reported to the Santa Monica police that somebody had broken into her car and stolen her gun, which, you guessed it, happened to be a .38 caliber. Presby said that at UCLA, Stephanie and John had become close, and they dated on and off for a few years after graduation. He said Stephanie was anguished over John's relationship with Sherry and his decision to marry her, and that Stephanie had confronted Sherry at her work. He told the jury that a month after John proposed, Stephanie wrote John's mother a letter saying, "I'm truly in love with John, and the past year has torn me up. I don't think I'll ever understand his decision." In the defense's opening statements, Stephanie's attorney, Mark Overland, went over Stephanie's accomplishments in the police force, that she was promoted to detective in 1994, and 2 years later she was promoted again to a more prestige position that was unusual at the time for a woman. She had been in the police force for 26 years and had received many commendations, until 2009, when she was charged with Sherry's murder. He said that there was more to John and Stephanie's relationship than what the prosecution was saying, but that Stephanie was not obsessed with him. And in fact, after Sherry's murder, John was the one who initiated contact with Stephanie, not the other way around. Not only that, but he told the jury that there were fingerprints, hairs, and palm prints from the scene that were not connected to Stephanie. He said those things point to somebody else. And as for that potentially damning bite mark evidence, Overland said that when the cold case unit reopened the case and retrieved the bite mark swab, it hadn't been stored correctly. The plastic tube that held the cotton swab with the saliva sample was found jutting through a hole in the evidence envelope. Overland said the detective's first theory of a botched robbery was correct, and he pointed out a similar burglary had occurred in the same neighborhood, several weeks after Sherry's murder. The state called to the stand one of John and Sherry's neighbors, who said that around noon on February 24th, 1986, her gardeners came to her with a purse they had found. The purse had Sherry's driver's license in it, and it had been discarded in their yard. Stephen Hooks, one of the original detectives on the case from 1986, testified that he arrived at the home about 7:45 that night. He described finding Sherry lying on her back on the living room floor. She had been wearing a red robe, a pink nightshirt, and black underwear. The court displayed a close-up photo of Sherry's face. One of her eyes was swollen shut, and her mouth was open. Her hands were held up in a defensive pose. Now, there was a lot of forensic testimony, and I mean hours of it, so I'm going to try and break that part down as best I can. It's a little confusing, so try to stick with me here. Let's start with the two broken fingernails that had been found on the floor. The first broken fingernail contained a DNA mixture from three people, and the possible contributors were Sherry, Stephanie, and then a third unknown person. Stephanie was noted as a possible contributor, and approximately 1 in 26,000 women would similarly be considered. The third possible contributor left a very low level, more consistent with a casual sort of contact. The second broken fingernail contained DNA where Sherry and Stephanie could be contributors. The stats regarding Stephanie were 1 in 9,000 women, and the stats regarding Sherry were 1 in 100. Then there were two of Sherry's fingernails that were damaged that were tested, and that possibly contained blood. DNA on one of the damaged nails was a mixture from at least two people. Sherry was the possible major contributor, and approximately 1 in 9 billion women would similarly be considered. And Stephanie was possibly a minor contributor to the mixture, and approximately 1 in 10 women would similarly be considered. And on the other damaged fingernail, there were weak and incomplete results from at least three persons. So in other words, it's likely not a coincidence that Stephanie's DNA is a possible contributor on all of this evidence. And about that bite mark, Jennifer Francis, a criminalist who analyzed a lot of the forensic evidence in this case, testified that there was a major profile and a minor profile found on that bite mark swab. The minor profile had DNA alleles that were consistent with Sherry, and the major profile was a match to the DNA from Stephanie. And just to put it into perspective, the odds that it could be from somebody else would be 1 in 402.1 quadrillion people. Francis testified that compared to the population on Earth, that's 100 million Earths. Then there was the fingerprint evidence. LAPD Latin fingerprint expert George Herrera testified that he analyzed fingerprints from the homicide scene as well as from Sherry's BMW. The fingerprints were categorized as either identifiable or unidentifiable. The prints that were unidentifiable were either smeared or smudged, making it impossible to get a decent print. And the ones that were identifiable matched either Sherry, John, or a friend of theirs. John and that friend had been ruled out as suspects early on in the investigation. There was an identifiable print from a telephone in the townhome that was unknown, but it did not match Stephanie. So no fingerprints from Stephanie were found in the home or in the BMW. Other items at the scene either returned incomplete profiles or profiles that matched Sherry. Stephanie's former roommate from right before the time of the murder, Michael Hargreaves, also took the stand. He said that Stephanie was extremely in shape and that her level of strength was superior. He said she exercised every day and lifted weights. He testified that Stephanie had told him that her boyfriend's name was John, but he said he never saw or met John. One night at about 1 or 2 in the morning, he said that Stephanie woke him up. She was crying, and she told him that John had broken up with her and that he was going to marry somebody else who was a nurse. He said it appeared that John had been using Stephanie and that he had been dating Stephanie and the nurse at the same time. He said he never saw Stephanie cry over anybody else. And then on another occasion, he said that Stephanie told him that she went to the nurse's workplace and had a confrontation with her at the hospital. Hargreaves also testified that after Sherry's murder, Stephanie told him that she lost her gun and not that it was stolen, as she had originally reported to the police. The time came for John Rutten to testify, something that spectators of the trial had long been looking forward to. He recalled to the jury how he and Stephanie met at UCLA and dated casually for a few years after graduating. He said they took a few trips together, went on multiple dates a few times a month, and had sex many times, but that they were not serious and they were never in a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship. John, who has since remarried, broke down into tears several times during his testimony. He described meeting Sherry one night and how he was immediately smitten with her. He said that within a year of meeting Sherry, he proposed to her. He said that shortly after they became engaged, he received a phone call from Stephanie, who was crying, and she asked him to come over to her apartment. He agreed, and when he got there, he said that Stephanie was distraught over his decision to marry another woman. He said he thought it was odd since he hadn't spoken with Stephanie for over a year, and he believed that they were just friends. He said Stephanie asked him multiple times to have sex with her, and they eventually did, because in part, he said he didn't know how to calm her down. He said afterwards, he made it clear to Stephanie that he was still planning on marrying Sherry. One night after that, John said that Sherry came home from work and was very upset. He said he then told her about how he had slept with Stephanie, but that Sherry appeared to know that already. He said that they talked it out and decided to continue with their plans to get married. And he said he didn't see or speak to Stephanie again until after the murder. John said that a few weeks after Sherry's death, Lyle Mayer, one of the lead detectives in the case, told John that Stephanie had been cleared as a suspect. He said Stephanie never offered him condolences or reached out after Sherry's murder. And he said that a few years later, he again met up with her and they had sex two more times. Entries from Stephanie's journal from back in the 1980s were admitted into evidence. The journal mentioned John, but no other boyfriends. In June 1985, Stephanie wrote, "We really didn't do much. I really didn't feel like working. I found out that John is getting married. I was very depressed. This is very bad. My concentration is negative 10. 2 weeks later, she wrote, "I really didn't feel like working. Too stressed out about John. I've had a real hard time concentrating these days, so I called up and said I didn't feel well." Police records showed that Stephanie did indeed take that day off. In December 1985, just 2 months before Sherry's murder, Stephanie wrote, "I went and picked up my mail. Unfortunately, I got a card from Mrs. Rutten. This made me very, very, very sad." Jane Weaver, a retired NYPD officer, testified that she worked with Stephanie from 1985 to 1987. She said one day Stephanie showed her a lockpicking toolkit she said she had been trained to use. And I probably don't need to spell out why the state wanted that testimony in. Mark Safarik, executive director of Forensic Behavioral Sciences, also testified. He's a behavioral analyst who determines how violent crimes happen and why. He studied police reports, photographs, and went over the evidence from the 1986 investigation. He also visited Sherry and John's former residence in 2010. He testified that in his opinion, it was not a burglary gone wrong, and he came to this conclusion for a number of reasons. One, the townhome was part of a complex that would be a risky choice for a burglar. There was a wall and fence around it and a locked front gate. He noted that other apartment complexes in the area didn't have such security. Number two, the unit was in a central location, increasing the risk that somebody could be seen coming or going. Number three, there was no sign of forced entry, and there was a sign that showed that the unit had an alarm system. Safarik also brought up the fact that somebody had left the scene in Sherry's BMW, and yet they abandoned it and nothing was taken from it. In fact, the only other thing taken from the residence was Sherry's purse, which was found outside on the property. The upstairs was undisturbed. There was a jewelry box in the master bedroom that was never touched. Further, Safarik said the scene had been staged. The table drawer in the living room that had been pulled out It wasn't really a logical place for a burglar to look for valuables, he said. He said, what I saw was an attempt to create the illusion that the motive in this crime was an interrupted burglary. In his opinion, the actual crime went something like this. There was an initial attack in the breakfast nook. Sherry broke away and the killer pursued her and attacked her again in the entryway where the broken fingernails and blood was found. The fight then moved to the living room where the killer picked up a vase and smashed Sherry's face with it. The killer then grabbed a blanket, wrapped it around the gun to muffle the shots, and shot Sherry 3 times. He concluded that the stereo equipment found by the doorway was moved after the killing, because it would have been disturbed in the struggle if it had been there before. Now, before we get into the defense's case, I just want to quickly recap some of the state's main pieces of evidence. Stephanie had been in love with John and was very upset about John marrying another woman. The gun used in the killing is likely the same type of gun that Stephanie said had been stolen just a couple weeks after the murder. The bullets used in the murder match the type of bullets the LAPD used back in the 1980s, and we know that Stephanie was a police officer then. Stephanie is a possible, and in some cases even likely, contributor to much of the DNA found at the scene. And she's a major contributor to the DNA swab from the bite mark on Sherry's arm. And not only that, but we heard testimony that the scene had likely been staged to look like a burglary. The defense's case included character witnesses, as well as trying to combat the state's DNA evidence with their own by introducing DNA that could not definitively be attributed to Stephanie. They called Evangelina Flores to the stand, who worked as a housekeeper in the unit next door to John and Sherry. On the morning of February 24, 1986, Flores said she heard a sound coming through the wall from Sherry's residence. She said it sounded like 2 people fighting, followed by a scream, 2 loud thuds or booms, and a door slamming. After that, it was silent until she heard a car drive off. Andrea Dillon, a Latin fingerprint examiner with the LAPD, testified as an expert on fingerprints and fingerprint comparisons, and she too analyzed fingerprints from Sherry and John's residence. She found multiple identifiable fingerprints that could not be attributed to Sherry, John, or Stephanie. This included fingerprints that had been found on the stereo equipment stacked by the door to the garage. Michael Alexander, a retired LAPD officer, testified that he and Stephanie worked patrol in 1985 and then on and off again for a number of years. He worked with Stephanie the day after the murder, on Tuesday, February 25th, 1986, and also on that Thursday. He said he saw no injuries on Stephanie and heard no complaints about any injuries either. Carl Olson testified that he had worked for the Santa Monica Police Department as their records manager. On March 9, 1986, he said that there were 2 additional auto burglaries from parking structures in the same area where Stephanie had reported the theft of her gun. Patricia Fant, a private forensic firearm examiner and former LA County Sheriff's deputy, examined the blanket from the crime scene and testified that she could only tell that the blanket contained barrel cylinder gap discharge, which only a revolver emits. She examined the bullets from the crime scene and testified that there was no way to tell who the manufacturer of the bullets were. She also testified that she found a hair on the blanket, as well as shoe prints that were unaccounted for. The defense's character witnesses included friends who testified that they never saw Stephanie ever be violent to anybody, and a coworker who said he saw her make many arrests and that none of them had ever been violent. Stephanie herself did not take the stand. And if you're wondering at this point about that other burglary that had taken place in John and Sherry's neighborhood just weeks after the murder, the trial judge didn't allow the defense to present that evidence to the jury. And here's why. There were numerous dissimilarities between the 2 instances. In the other burglary, which occurred in April 1986, the suspects took jewelry, went upstairs to the master bedroom, and left in a waiting vehicle. There were also signs of forced entry in that case, and the victim in that case had not been physically attacked, as had previously been reported. In his closing arguments, Deputy District Attorney Paul Nunez spoke about what a happy time it was for Sherry and John in the months leading up to her death, and by contrast, how upset Stephanie was over their marriage. He argued that the murder occurred due to Stephanie's jealousy. He said no one else had any kind of motive to kill her. He played portions of her interview with the detectives in 2009 and then called out all of the lies. He said she lied about her feelings for John, lied about the confrontation between her and Sherry, saying that it had been friendly, lied about Sherry's work being on her way to work. He said in reality, Stephanie worked 20 miles away at the time, meaning that she had to drive out of her way 20 miles to confront her. Not exactly a friendly meeting. He then again outlined the DNA evidence, the bullets, Stephanie reporting her gun stolen, and how that type of gun matched the injuries to Sherry's face. He also pointed out that Stephanie had 3 days off prior and including the day of the murder, meaning she had the opportunity to commit the crime also. He stated that since she was a police officer, she knew how to get past locks, how to lift fingerprints, knew how to get rid of the gun. He said, "This is evidence that is proof beyond a reasonable doubt that Stephanie Lazarus committed this crime." Stephanie's attorney, Mark Overland, told the jury that they could not trust the state's witnesses and says that they could not solve the case until supposedly more than 20 years later. He tried to place doubt on the DNA evidence from the bite mark, noting that the packaging had been ratted and that nobody could prove where it had been for 20 years. He suggested the possibility that somebody may have tampered with it. He also said the state's theory makes no sense. He said there was a lot of evidence from the scene that didn't match Sherry, didn't match John, and didn't match Stephanie. So whose was it? The trial itself lasted for about 3 weeks. The jury, comprised of 8 women and 4 men, deliberated for about a day and a half. On March 8th, 2012, they read their verdict.
People of the State of California versus Stephanie Eileen Lazarus, case number BA. 357423. We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant, Stephanie Eileen Lazarus, guilty of the crime of murder of Sherry Rasmussen.
Guilty. Stephanie showed no emotion as the jury announced the verdict. 2 months later, in May 2012, Stephanie was sentenced to 27 years to life. She has appealed the case, but it has since been denied. I tried to find the words to describe this case, but I think the LAPD police chief Charlie Beck said it best in a statement he released after the verdict. He called it a tragedy on every level. He said, "Not only did the family of Sherry Rasmussen lose a wife and a daughter, a life that can never be returned, but also the LAPD family felt a sense of betrayal to have an officer commit such a terrible crime." And that's all for this episode of Court Junkie. I'd love to know your thoughts on the case, so please hit me up on Twitter at Court Junkie Pod, on Facebook by joining the Court Junkie discussion group, or you can email me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. There's a ton of information online about this case, including Stephanie's full unedited interrogation video. I'll include links in the show notes as well as on my website at courtjunkie.com. As a reminder, if you like this podcast, please consider leaving me a review. Reviews help podcasts get more exposure on iTunes. To donate to this podcast, please go to patreon.com/courtjunkie. All donations go directly to this podcast so I can continue to put out free content each week. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time.